Now we're going to take a walk through one of the warmer, stickier places on Earth, the rainforest of Sumatra. Filmmaker Andrew Goldberg brought us this audio journey of his search for the elusive kind of ape called a gibbon.
Our trip to the rainforest of Indonesia started in New York, and after several connections, landed us in the city of Medan, the largest on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. From this crowded city of over 2 million people, we caught a flight on a crumbling 30-year-old propeller plane with no door on the cockpit, deep into the interior of the island to the small village of Katambe, complete with chickens and other animals roaming freely from home to home. In the local schoolhouse, the children began to sing to us when they saw our recording equipment. To go into the rainforest from here, we could only proceed on foot. After a full day of walking deep into the rainforest, it struck me that we'd finally gotten away from not just the Western world and all of its anxieties, but also from all of the people. Where we were, my cell phone clearly read, "No service." Sitting and listening to the rainforest was calming, and holding perfectly still, we tried to identify as many different sounds as we could. At the end of the next day, we were determined to see a gibbon, or at least hear one of their calls. Gibbons, which are smaller members of the primate family, are well known for their long arms and hands that they use to swing from branch to branch to branch as they race through the treetops. Their speed makes them difficult to see, but their distinctive call is easy to identify.
They have big tree there. They stay all the sometime in the big tree.
To get from here to where the gibbons are, how many meters is it?
1 kilo from here.
A kilometer.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
After hiking more like 5 kilometers, all of it uphill, we finally came to the place where our guide said we could hear the gibbons. But upon arrival, we heard something else, which to me sounded like a giant angry duck. Our guide explained it was not a duck, but rather a large bird known as the hornbill. A few seconds later, however, we got to hear the gibbon call. Success. Where we were in Sumatra, the forests are largely pristine, but in much of the other rainforests of Indonesia, this is not the case. Massive demand for palm oil, used in such things as food and cosmetics, and demand for exotic woods such as teak and mahogany, has led to rapid deforestation here and the subsequent death of so many of these birds and animals. On our last day in Indonesia, as we drove back toward the city, we stopped in an area that had once been lush forest, but was now hundreds of square kilometers of empty land, entirely cut down. In contrast to the cacophony of the forest, this virtually dead place was truly saddening. Now that I'm home, I've uploaded the call of the gibbon into my digital alarm clock to wake me up every morning. It's both a happy and sad sound that reminds me not only of the beauty in this world, but also the heartbreaking reality of our capacity to destroy it.
That story was produced by filmmaker Andrew Goldberg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
With the housing market in turmoil for the past year, the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, has come to the rescue of many. It's now responsible for about a third of new mortgages, 10 times more than just a few years ago. And as the federally insured loan program has grown, so has its rate of defaults. The FHA is expected to acknowledge soon that its insurance reserves have slipped below a critical threshold. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Not everyone can get a mortgage anymore. The days of if you can breathe, you can get a loan are over. But it might be hard to tell from watching the ads that are out there.
Bank. We're authorized by the federal government to offer FHA loans to homeowners with less than perfect credit.
This ad comes from a company called Premium Capital Funding LLC. It goes by the name Top Dot Mortgage.
And your credit score may not even be a factor. Applying is easy. Call the number on your screen.
According to FHA data, over the last 2 years, Top Dot's loans defaulted at nearly 2.5 times the national average. In some cases, the borrowers never made a single payment. FHA Commissioner David Stevens says any FHA lender whose default rate is more than 150% of the norm has a problem.
An institution that has that high a compare ratio is something that would be very concerning to me and will be one that we're looking at more closely going forward. And if they don't perform at the levels that we would expect and that the taxpayers would expect, we need to make sure that they either improve or they get out of the program.
Top Dot officials declined to be interviewed for this story. But in an email, a company lawyer said Top Dot is working to improve its loan performance by, among other things, adopting more stringent credit requirements. But Top Dot isn't alone. There are more than 900 small FHA-approved lenders that experts say have unacceptable default rates. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
The FHA business has been like a magnet for smaller lenders looking to carve out niches in loans that have lower down payments and slightly lower underwriting requirements.
FHA requires only 3.5% down, and credit score requirements are flexible. Some lenders are taking full advantage of that flexibility, and some are probably breaking the law. It reminds Sakala of the subprime mortgage market of the past.
You know, in the current mortgage market environment where we kind of have plain vanilla mortgages, there's not a lot of opportunity for the small entrepreneurial, is the best way we could describe it, company who wants to make a niche for themselves in the mortgage market. FHA is one of the only avenues still left.
A mortgage company can follow all of FHA's guidelines to the letter and still issue some really bad loans, loans that are destined to fail. But now FHA officials are making it clear they aren't okay with that, says Brian Chappelle with Potomac Partners, a mortgage industry consulting firm.
The message that's being sent is that there is a new sheriff in town at FHA and that they are going to pursue investigations to see just what the causes are for these high default rates, where in the past, I don't think a lot of people felt that they really had anything to worry about if they had a high default rate.
FHA recently helped shut down one major lender, and now it's going after another, Ideal Mortgage Bankers, also known as Lend America. The company is fighting the government's efforts to kick it out of the FHA program and said in a statement it plans to continue to provide affordable financing for those borrowers in need. And the reality is, these companies with unacceptably high default rates are on the margins. Guy Sakala says most of FHA's defaults are being driven by the recession.
They've made loans during a period when housing prices have been declining, so a lot of the loans are underwater. It's not like anybody's really immune from this, so it would be expected that FHA would take some serious losses in this kind of economy and environment.
FHA officials say they're open to tightening the loan program's rules, but they say there's a careful balance to strike. If the rules are too tough, some buyers would be pushed out of the market, buyers that are needed to help the housing market recover. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Republicans have been harsh critics of Democratic plans to revamp the nation's health care system. But until now, Republicans have not offered a detailed proposal of their own. House Republicans finally put theirs in writing. It was posted online last night. This bill has no hope of becoming law, we're told, though it may be offered as an alternative when the House takes up the Democratic plan in the coming days. NPR's Julie Robner has seen the Republican proposal and has this report.
In a lot of ways, the House GOP health bill reads like a compilation of greatest hits for when Republicans ran the House from 1995 through 2006. It includes several bills that passed the chamber repeatedly during those years, but never made it through the Senate. Florida Republican Congressman Adam Putnam conceded as much in describing the measure yesterday.
It is a much more simple approach to bringing down costs in health care along the lines of ideas that we've been talking about for a long time.
Among the more familiar pieces of the GOP bill are provisions to cap damage awards in medical malpractice lawsuits. That, says House Republican Conference Chairman Mike Pence,
will end the era of junk lawsuits and defensive medicine.
Another perennial proposal calls for creation of something called association health plans, which Pence describes as
allowing new associations to be formed on a nationwide basis so that groups of businesses and individuals can experience the kind of savings that major corporations do.
Pence also made a point of highlighting what their 230-page bill won't do. It won't cut Medicare or raise taxes, a claim the Democrats can't make about their nearly 2,000-page measure.
With the creation of 111 new bureaucracies and programs, with the expansion or creation of 34 new entitlements and hundreds of billions of dollars of tax increases, that this is a government takeover of health care. That's not what the American people want. And I think as they understand that, we believe it will create an opportunity to offer a Republican alternative that focuses on lowering the cost of health insurance.
Democrats, however, like New Jersey's Rob Andrews, were not impressed with the Republicans' document.
They've had 14 years to come up with a plan, and this is it? Their plan won't save American consumers money. It won't come anywhere close to covering every American. It will not rein in the abusive practices of the insurance industry. It will not save the Treasury money or cut the deficit. It will not re-stimulate our economy. Other than that, it's probably a pretty good idea.
In particular, Democrats like Florida's Debbie Wasserman Schultz were surprised that the GOP bill doesn't even address the problem of how to guarantee coverage for people with pre-existing health conditions.
I mean, that is the bare minimum that everyone in America essentially agrees should be part of any health care reform proposal.
And House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer used part of his weekly sit-down with reporters to explain why Democrats have long opposed the idea of letting insurance be sold across state lines.
We believe that would very possibly gut consumer protections and encourage a race to the bottom where insurance companies would go to the states that required the least amount of protection and therefore the cheapest policies, and that everybody could go and purchase what they think is a cheap policy, but which at time of health care crisis does not protect them adequately.
One thing the Republican bill does do is reach out to the party's base. It includes provisions Republicans tried and failed to get into the Democrats' bill, like stricter rules barring funding for abortion and illegal immigrants. It also includes a few things that are in the Democrats' bills, but that many Democrats object to. One example, new rules to allow the sale of generic copies of expensive biologic drugs that are seen as highly favorable to brand-name drug makers. Still, despite its lack of tax breaks or insurance mandates, Republican Congressman Putnam says he's confident the GOP bill would help more people get insurance coverage, primarily because it will help hold down health care costs.
Anything that you can do to improve health care affordability will improve health care accessibility.
The official word on just how the Republican bill would affect either affordability or accessibility is expected from the Congressional Budget Office in the coming days. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Now let's bring another voice into our coverage. NPR News analyst Juan Williams is in New York City and joined us from our bureau there. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning.
Why don't we start there in New York? No surprise that Mayor Bloomberg won, but did anyone see such a narrow victory coming?
No, the polls really had him winning by double digits, and it turns out he wins by about 5%. And, you know, what's interesting here is sort of the anti-incumbent fervor that's evident throughout last night's results. And in the case of New York City, Mayor Bloomberg had really reversed a term limit issue here to allow himself the opportunity to run for that third term. And he was running against an opponent, Bill Thompson, who had little money and little in the name of name recognition. But he blasted Mayor Bloomberg as an elitist who had abandoned the middle class and broken the promise on term limits. So apparently it had much more impact than anybody knew, especially given the amount of money that Mayor Bloomberg spent.
And looking more broadly at yesterday's elections, what stood out for you in these results?
I think Bob McDonnell's victory in Virginia, Renee, You know, that was a victory for a man who was a social conservative for almost all of his political career, but he ran as a pragmatic politician focused on solving the state's problems with regard to the economy, jobs, and transportation. This is a year after Virginia supported Barack Obama.
And of course, we're talking about the governor race here.
Right. But again, what you see is that independents had split in that state. It's typically traditionally been a Republican state. Last year, independents split. Yesterday, Bob McDonald was able to get a 2-1 victory among independent voters in Virginia. So he raised the money, stayed on message, and was able to lead a GOP sweep of the not only governorship, but lieutenant governor and attorney general. This is really a big victory for Bob McDonald.
Well, also in New Jersey, also a governor's race there, also won by a Republican. These voters told exit pollsters that they approved of President Obama. I mean, a contradiction there?
Well, you know what? In Virginia, 56% of the voters said Obama was not a factor. In New Jersey, 60%, Renee, said Obama was not a factor. In fact, if you look at it, in New Jersey, 57% of them who came out yesterday said they approve of Barack Obama. And in Virginia, again, 51% said President Obama has their approval. The Democrats in both races were not able to get Barack Obama's supporters to absolutely support them. In New Jersey, for example, only about 75%, according to exit polls, of people who approved of President Obama then went on to vote for John Corzine. Obama and his standing right now are not the issue. In both cases, in Virginia and New Jersey, 85% of voters in Virginia said they're worried about the economy. In New Jersey, 89%. Those were the dominant issues of the night. And in terms of President Obama's legislative agenda, again, it wasn't health care. It wasn't cap and trade, the climate bill. It was all about the economy last night for these voters.
Although let's speak very briefly, just a few seconds here, about a congressional race in upstate New York that turned out very differently, attracted national attention. Sarah Palin, other prominent Republicans backing the conservative candidate, who in the end lost the seat for the Republicans. What lesson there, if any, is to be learned?
Well, GOP chaos. This is a very interesting race because in that 23rd district, you had Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska, Fred Thompson, former Tennessee senator, coming in at the last minute, backing Doug Hoffman, the conservative, Didi Scozzafava, who was the Republican nominee, pulling out, then supporting Bill Owens, the Democrat, who eventually won. But what you see here is the kind of anger and rage, and especially the energized base among Republicans. And yesterday we saw Republicans turning out in big numbers, but in that district it didn't work for them.
Yeah, and losing the seat. Juan, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Renee.
And NPR News analyst Juan Williams.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We're going now to Manhattan's Lower East Side, where it's common to encounter strong feelings, in this case, strong feelings about pickles. Sarah Reynolds has this profile of one man in the pickle business.
Every Tuesday, a truck pulls up to Alan Kaufman's Pickle Emporium, the Pickle Guys, and drops off thousands of cucumbers. He pours about 2,000 of them into a barrel to start.
We got a last box going in now.
Tuesday is pickling day. Okay. Kaufman opened his shop in 2000 in a neighborhood fondly known as the Old Pickle District. He learned to pickle with some of the old-timers before opening his own place.
This is salt brine. The amount of time that they sit in the barrels will determine what kind of pickles they're going to be.
According to the New York Food Museum, pickling was a booming business in the early 1900s.
What's up? What can I get for you?
For decades, there were about 200 pickle shops in the area. Today, there are very few.
Hot sour, hot half sour?
Hot sour.
Pickles are very important to some people. Some people get very irate if the pickle's not just perfect. They're either too sour or not sour enough. I want them straight. I don't want them crooked. People are very fussy when it comes to their pickles.
Not hot enough?
Kaufman is a jolly 50 years old, with a neatly trimmed beard and a shirt with a talking pickle that says, "Smells great, tastes better." His shop is filled with neat rows of dark red open barrels, all full of pickles.
Okay, we sell sour pickles, three-quarter sour pickles, half sour pickles, new pickles, hot sour pickles, hot half sour pickles, and horseradish pickles. And that's just the pickles we sell.
Pickling is a delicate matter. Customers and picklers alike have their tendencies, and they're stubborn about them. Nancy Ralph, director of the New York Food Museum, also sees the pickler in the pickle.
It's an improvisational art, so people experiment with different flavors and come up with their favorite flavors that sort of matches their own taste to where the market they're trying to reach.
Hot sour, hot half sour, horseradish.
And as a consequence, it takes on sort of the personality of the owner. So people create a product that tastes like who they are.
Well, you like hot stuff, these are hot.
Alan Kaufman has rules, but they're simple. Don't put your hands in the barrels. He'll get the pickles for you with a big silver bowl.
I love it. Give me one more.
No napkins. Use your sleeves. You get a pickle to eat while you wait, and you'll like it. People seem to find the rules entertaining and come back for more. Len Zerling comes in to buy pickles for his mother. He loves the smell of the place.
Sweet, sour, brine, salt. What good is a steak or a hot dog without pickles? Everybody has their own taste. I like half sours. My mother loves sours.
Kaufman hands him a pickle.
One bite?
Kaufman says that a good sandwich is only a good sandwich without a really great pickle. And he knows he's right. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Reynolds in New York.